Our next presenter is Ronald Manderscheid. Ron has served as the Director of Mental Health and Substance Use Programs at the Global Health Sector of SRA International since 2006. In this capacity, he's developing new demonstration and research projects around mental health and substance use services, programs, and systems using a public health framework. Concurrently, he's adjunct professor at the Department of Mental Health, Bloomberg School of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University, a member of the Secretary of Health and Human Services Advisory Committee on Healthy People 2020, and president-elect of ACMHA, the College for Behavioral Health Leadership. Dr. Manderscheid serves on the boards of the Employee Assistance Research Foundation, the Danya Institute, and the Public Manager. Previously, Dr. Manderscheid served as branch chief, survey and analysis branch for the Federal Center of Mental Health Services at SAMHSA. Dr. Manderscheid is currently on the Governing Council of APHA, current president of the Federal Executive Institute Alumni Association Foundation, past president of of the same foundation, and past chair of the APHA Mental Health Section. He served as principal editor for 8 editions of Mental Health US. He's also authored numerous scientific and professional publications on services to people with mental illnesses. He's the participant of both federal and professional awards, a great number of them, too many to list here. Dr. Manderscheid worked in a variety of positions with the National Institute of Mental Health, received a BA degree in sociology from Loras College, an MA degree in sociology anthropology from Marquette University, and a PhD in sociology with a specialization in social psychology and statistics from the University of Maryland. He's also a graduate of the Federal Executive Institute. Ron.
So I'm your colleague from the mental health section, basically, in short. And I brought along Mental Health US. I'll pass this around if you want. This is the, unfortunately, this 2004 version is still the current version, as the government has not done a new edition. If you want an e-copy of this, give me a card and I'll be glad to provide that to you. Also, what I'm going to talk about relates to the work I've done on the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Healthy People 2020, and there is an e-version of a report that goes into the social and physical determinants of health, and I'll be glad to provide that to you also. So, I guess to begin, we are thrilled that we're on the cusp of making health a basic human right. And we're thrilled that the House passed health reform last Saturday night. So we ought to. Now we need to go the next step and close the deal. So your help will be badly needed with your senators to so they don't get scared and run away. The Senate is more conservative than the House, and this is all going to come to fruition over the next several weeks there. Okay, so let me begin first with President Obama's 8 principles of health reform. You see these here, you can read these for yourself. The first 4 of these really deal with issues about cost. The last 4 deal more with issues about health and health care. And the one I want to point out here is invest in prevention and wellness, which has always been the weak sister in health care, basically. These principles were written into the 2010 federal budget. So if you want to go in further detail on this, you can go and get the 2010 budget produced by the White House and read in detail about them. Most of you know these statistics. The one I would point out here is that we spend next to nothing on health. We spend zillions of dollars, now actually more than this, close to $2.5 trillion, on health care and virtually nothing on health. And we hope that the new health insurance bill will change that. I want to point out, speaking from the mental health and substance abuse point of view, if you look at the uninsured population, look at this 46 million people who most of the time don't have any health insurance, let's subtract 8 million children out of there. Those 8 million children are very likely to be covered by the SCHIP program. Let's subtract another 8 million undocumented immigrants. And there's a huge issue there. My personal belief is you should cover everybody. H1N1 doesn't begin or end whether you're a citizen. It's much broader than that. Then you're down to about 30 million people. Of those 30 million people who are uninsured, adults, a third have a mental health or substance abuse issue, and most of those people are at 200% or less of poverty. So the rate of uninsurance among people with mental health or substance abuse issues is twice what it is in the general population. And you all know, and you also, if you watch the news this morning, know that we rank 30th in infant mortality in the United States, and this was literally just reported this morning. In doing health reform, we don't want to end up with wood hens here. And we also recognize that there's a huge issue of this type. Everybody is afraid of health reform for fear their own role is going to disappear in health reform. And we have to go beyond that fear and say, we're moving into something new. There's all kinds of new opportunities in the new system. We have to get over it, basically. Let's see. The underlying model of the work that we are doing on the Secretary's Committee basically says that one end you have illness. Health is not the other end of the continuum of illness. These are not two ends of one continuum. In fact, health is a completely different dimension here. There's now a lot of documented research to show this. The original work on this was done in 1981. We're just now beginning to close the deal on that. The concept of recovery is a bridging concept between the dimension of illness and the dimension of wellness. The Centers for Disease Control is developing some new measurement methodologies on personal well-being and quality of life as two key domains, internal and external, that relate to this dimension. They are very likely to appear as part of Healthy People 2020. So obviously the illness dimension deals with illness care, deals with health care, what we've been talking about all these years. The wellness dimension deals with health care, promotion, and I want to put on the table here the next step up from prevention and promotion is the social and physical determinants of health. And Representative Kennedy says, stop it where it starts. Well, it starts in the social and physical determinants of health. It does not start when you get the disease, basically. So, in the evolution of these bills that are on the Hill, there are several concepts here. Prevention and promotion for persons, which is really how do you take the clinical system and introduce prevention and promotion for individual people. Prevention and promotion for populations, which is much more what APHA is about. How do we do population-level interventions that will help us move this agenda? Should we have population health coaches? Interesting idea. And is there such a thing as, in parallel to health insurance, population insurance? And all of these concepts are being debated currently as part of the evolution of these various bills that are being considered. So if you move then further upstream, the Healthy People 2020 framework is a framework first of the social and physical determinants of health, and only secondarily of health care and epidemiology, the more traditional models. So if you look at the 80 version, the 90 version, the 2000 version, the 2010 version, all used a traditional model. The indicators all focus on epidemiology, or they focus on health care. There are no indicators upstream focusing on the social and physical determinants of health. The issue in the social and physical determinants of health is what can you do about this? So let's look a little more here. I don't know whether you can see this in the back. This is in the report I'll send you if you're interested. So here you have a person, and the person embedded in their social context. So first, you know, the person as a person who has a physiology and a psychology and does certain behaviors. then in the context of a family and a community and a workplace and a culture and so on. This is traditionally called the social ecological model, and obviously this changes somewhat as you go across the course of your life. And the model won't look the same as when you're a child as when you're 80 years old, basically. So what this we're trying to do is say, how do we impact upon this through giving people information? So one of the things that will be developed is an online healthy people community targeted to everybody in the U.S. population. So if you want to go online and find information to help you with your own health problem, your child's health problem, your community's health problem, this will be out there. It will be possible to participate in various kinds of discussion groups, chat groups, work groups, community groups, all online. And the only feasible way of, you say you're going to reach 300 million people, the only feasible way of doing that is doing it online. So information, what types of programs that are needed, health-informed policy. So every single federal law should require that we look at the health effects of that law. We aren't there yet, but working on it. And then policies. What should be the policies of HHS and the units of HHS going forward here? And then on the other side over here, what outcomes can be achieved? How can we change your health? Behavioral outcomes, how can we change risk factors, diseases, conditions, injuries, well-being, health-related quality of life, and health equity? We are in a situation where we do not have health equity in the United States. So this is the underlying model. I commend your reading of that report, and I'll be glad to share it with you. And really, the question becomes, how do you take this and operationalize it? So one example of this in DC, if you look in Ward 8 in DC, in the District of Columbia, Ward 8 has the worst set of social indicators of any of the wards in DC. So if you look at drug use, you look at unemployment, you look at involvement in crime, and on and on and on, the numbers are the worst. So taking that Wheeler Terrace area of DC, we actually are beginning to build a collaborative in the community. So we went to the people of Ward 8 and we said, do you want to do this? What do you want to do about improving your own health in this community? And there's a lot of support and resiliency in Ward 8 to do this. So don't operate with the stereotype that we have communities that have no interest. These communities do have interest in this. So now we are moving into the next stage of having the community define the things it wants to work on over the next couple of years as a community. And some examples of this would be, if you look in Ward 8, there are virtually no stores that sell quality food. You can buy a lot of junk food. There are a lot of McDonald's and so on out there. There are a lot of bars, but there are no stores that sell good food. How do we introduced stores into that community that sell good food? How do we improve the health education of the children that are coming up in that community? Another interest of the community. So what you need to do is watch this. The underlying idea here is a lot of this stuff is going to be done from the grassroots up. It's not going to come from Washington, D.C. and come down. It's going to start in places like Wheeler Terrace in Ward 8 in the District of Columbia. Now, if you look at national health reform, this all fits in this arena right here. So what you've heard most about and what they talked all day Saturday about was universal coverage. And the most they are going to do is define this in some way, which says we're going to put so much money on this problem, we think it will cover this many people, and we're going to leave all of these problems to the Secretary of HHS. So developing the medical or health home, the Secretary of HHS, you go and define this and implement it. Getting into prevention and promotion, we're going to put $34 billion on prevention and promotion. In the Senate Finance Committee bill, it's $34 billion. This money's going to be given to CDC. How are we going to do this? Quality improvement and payment reform. Secretary of HHS is going to do this. And it'll fall to the Secretary of HHS to look at the financing and sustainability of the new Medicaid coverage that will come forward here. So the bill will get us started, but the bill won't carry us there. So it'll do one part of this. It'll do insurance reform. It's not going to do some of these key other pieces. Obviously, we have a whole lot of work to do in this arena going forward here. Now I want to point out one other thing to you. So one of the things that I've been very engaged in over the last 2 years is an entity called the Whole Health Campaign. This ties into mental health and addictive health. We have actually brought together 109 mental health and substance abuse organizations that agree on a very simple agenda. We want good health insurance coverage, good integrated care. By integrated care, I mean here mental health, substance abuse, and primary care for people with mental health and substance abuse disorders, and good prevention and promotion interventions. You can say those three things in less than 10 seconds on an elevator, and we finally, after 6 months, got agreement that those three things would be our basic agenda. We've worked directly with the congressional staff and the federal staff on these issues. We went to all 17 of the presidential campaigns last year and so on. This year, we have produced 9 policy papers on national health reform. These are all available at the website you see there, www.wholehealthcampaign.org. And more recently, we've been actually engaged up on the Hill. We did a briefing for the House staff in September, and we still think there's more needed with the staff of the Senate Finance Committee on parity for mental health and substance abuse care. So although they used the word parity, they didn't define it in the bill, and if you don't define it, it's meaningless, basically. So if you want to plug into some of these ideas in these policy papers, The ideas in the papers are generic first. So universal coverage is a generic idea. We then carry it down also to the next level and look at mental health substance abuse. Financing is a generic issue and so on. So you may have some more general interest in this in terms of, you know, your own backgrounds in these areas. So I commend these papers to you as well. And I think, you know, my final point here is you have to yourself become involved in this. This week, you need to contact your senator and tell your senator you want national health reform. You want them to support the melded bill that's going to come out of the Senate in a few days, and that is critical for the well-being of the American population and critical for the well-being of the U.S. economy that we do this. This is not just personal well-being of people. The competitiveness of the U.S. economy and the ability of the U.S. economy to function in the future is very highly tied with this. So with that, I'm going to stop. I don't think I have. So you, I guess you can ask yourself, what are the two or three things you're going to do here? So think about it. One thing you're going to do is you're going to contact your senators and ask them, what is the second thing? You're going to talk to a colleague at the APHA meeting and say, you should do the same here. Okay, good. So here's my contact information. I was introduced as being from SRA, which is true. I'm also taking on a new position on December 1st as the executive director of the National Association of County Behavioral Health and Developmental Disability Directors. So we will be reaching out to many places for help in doing this. If we're doing good things, tell us. If we're doing bad things, tell us. But we want to collaborate, we want to work, and we think the counties have a huge role here to play and a lot of water to carry in terms of implementing national health reform. So thank you very much, Chair.
Behavioral health being treated within In other words, what would your definition of parity be? How do you see its integration with primary care within that? You know, what do you think are some of the key elements of making that?
So, first on parity, that's being debated right now. And the traditional parity was, we want annual and lifetime limits on insurance that are the same as the annual lifetime limits for other disorders. And we pretty much have achieved that, including in Medicare. We had a big win in Medicare a couple of years ago. Now we've gone on to the next level, and we're talking about things such as people in managed care need to have the same level of access to these benefits as people with other disorders, and the same scope of services. The big battle this week, and the big battle in the parity regulations, which are likely to come out literally in the next couple of days, will be whether they cover scope of services. So, you know, what have we actually put in the umbrella here? We've been very narrow and said, well, you know, we cover cognitive behavior therapy, but we don't cover work on obesity, and so on. How far are we going to go here? So that is the current issue. On the issue of integration with primary care, we think there are two models of the medical home. One model of the medical home is the medical home run by the primary care physician, and that will have some linkage to behavioral health care, and that will cover probably 95% of the U.S. population just fine. So if you have depression, you can go to a primary care physician, and that primary care physician will do a very good job of getting you on a med and getting you back to work. We also think there's another medical home run out of the behavioral health sector for people who have long-term chronic mental illness, people with schizophrenia, people with bipolar disorder, and so on. And we actually have a grant program that we went on the Hill and got funded through SAMHSA, where there are now demonstrations out in the community of building that side of the model. And we think both of these sides are going to go forward as part of national health reform and are probably needed. People with schizophrenia will not do well in a medical home operated in the primary care system. The other thing we've been trying to do there, and we hosted a meeting at the Carter Center a few months ago to have this discussion, is integrate into the medical home the concept of positive health promotion and health that really it ought to be called the health home, not the medical home, and it needs to have health promotion as part of its agenda. Well, it can't do that initially because the primary care people are not trained to do this, but in the long run, we need to be moving there, and we in behavioral health need to be moving there, and a big part of well-being and health promotion is behavior change, which is the appropriate purview of behavioral health care.
Just one thing. Particularly with drug usage, legal drug use, that's an area that's very complicated, and you have competing approaches in terms of criminalizing it or treating it as a public health problem. It needs to be intersectoral.
We need to pull some of these things apart. We do not believe that you should criminalize people who use drugs. They really need help. They don't need to be sitting in a jail or a prison somewhere. So that's principle number one, and principle number two, it isn't just illegal drugs. There's a huge issue currently with prescription drugs. A quarter of the children who went to college this fall are on psychotropic medications when they go to college, and what college kids do is they trade these things. So if I need to stay up tonight, I buy a few of these uppers from one of my colleagues so I don't sleep and I can study for my test tomorrow. All of this stuff is going on here, and we need to work on this as a society. You don't just work on it by saying, if you do this, I'm going to lock you up. That's an ineffective method of dealing with the problem.
Are there specific provisions for that in the overall plans?
There are specific provisions in health reform to begin covering substance abuse the way it should be covered. There's a long history. So 10 years ago in 1998, substance abuse was excluded under the rules of supplemental security income and Social Security disability insurance as an appropriate illness that created a disability. Said it wasn't an illness that created a disability, therefore it couldn't be covered. Well, that has had the consequence that we don't provide good care to people in Medicaid and Medicare, which are turned on or off by whether you're receiving SSI or SSDI. This health reform, the House version holds, will say we're going to do away with SSI and SSDI as requirements to turn on Medicare and Medicaid. If we do that, then all of those people who have substance abuse problems will become eligible for care under Medicaid, as they should have been all these years, basically.